As many of you know, we are in a study on the book of Exodus right now on Sunday mornings, and one of our prayers as we study is that we would continually see God doing Exodus, that we would be able to further experience and witness his liberating love. And last week was really awesome to me to kind of see Exodus in our midst. We rejoiced with people as they passed through the Christian Red Sea, which is baptism, and then we got to take the Lord's Supper together, which is the Christian Passover. Paul even puts those things together in 1 Corinthians, and it was a beautiful reminder of our freedom and God's faithfulness in Jesus. And in case you've forgotten, the Exodus story has been pretty intense so far. Way back in Genesis, God came to this guy named Abraham, and he said, "Hey, Abraham, I'm going to change the world through your family." And in Exodus, this family gets really big, so big that they are an entire nation, and they are in oppressive slavery under a series of ruthless and violent pharaohs down in Egypt. And God's people are sick and tired of being whipped in the hot Egyptian sun and building these cities for the pharaohs, working 25 hours a day, 8 days a week, and they cry out to God. They can't take any more of it. Exodus 2, last two verses of the chapter, they cry out to God, and God hears them. He shemas, that's the Hebrew word. He hears, and he responds, and he comes to rescue them and save them. But his rescue operation looks a little strange on the surface. God calls the timid, yet educated, "I murdered a guy back in Egypt, shepherd Moses, to go back to Egypt where he was raised and talk to the most powerful politician in the world and go, hey man, you need to let God's people go free." And as you can imagine, the first interaction, Pharaoh just kind of laughs right in Moses' face and goes, "Man, I've never even heard of your God, Yahweh." Israel's God, Yahweh. And then Yahweh kind of starts to flex his muscles just a little bit and show Egypt who he really is. And he does this in what we call the plagues. And with the plagues, God exposes the weaknesses of the Egyptian gods and slowly pries Pharaoh's fingers loose from his enslaving grip on Israel. And so through God's righteous judgment and his faithfulness to his promises, Pharaoh finally throws in the towel and tells Israel that they can go free after the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn. And in the last verse in Exodus 12 that we looked at several weeks ago, it says, "On that very day, Yahweh set the people of Israel free from Egypt, out of the land of Egypt." And this walks us right up to where we will be today in Exodus chapter 13. So if you have a copy of the scriptures, the old good old-fashioned paper Bible that will never die, amen. Or you can have your smartphone device there if you're really cool and trendy. You can get it out. Exodus chapter 13. We'll get there in a second. Now, on one level, you could say that this is actually one of the first pictures that we have of what living in freedom really looks like, because their slavery ended with chapter 12 because of the last verse in chapter 12. And so now we can start to think a little bit more closely about the second half of our big Exodus idea: set free, live free. But before we get there, let's just think for a couple minutes about something else really briefly. I'll even put it on the screens for you right down here. Some of you might know this passage from the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 3. He says, "One thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Messiah Jesus." I think I know what he's saying. He's saying that he's like this Olympic sprinter running the 100-meter dash, and he's straining and he's stretching. He's giving everything he's got, like his neck is out, ready to like break the ribbon there. And if he tries to look over his shoulder, if he's running as intensely as he is, if he tries to look backward while he's doing that, it won't be good. I mean, it won't be pretty. He's going to fall. He's going to trip. He's going to look like a huge idiot. Or he's going to like shift into somebody else's lane. It's going to slow him down. He's just not going to finish well. It's not going to be good. It won't be pretty. And that's why he says, "Forgetting what is behind, I press on." Now, obviously, this is good and it's true, and we don't disagree with Paul, and this is beautiful on its own terms, and we need to wrestle with what that means in the context of Philippians 3. You can go listen to our messages on Philippians. for that. But I do think these ideas are more complicated than meets the eye. Just change the metaphor for just a little bit. Let's just say that you are parallel parked downtown Greenville on the bridge in between Starbucks and Grill Marks and whatever else is right there. You're parallel parked, and you have to get to the goal of your driveway at home. But here's the catch. You have to do that without looking in any rear view or side mirrors. That's what you have to do. Now, what is the result going to be? We all know. Somebody getting in a wreck, all right? You're going to sideswipe somebody. You're going to back into somebody. Somebody's going to sideswipe you. It's not going to be pretty. Somebody is going to get hit somewhere. Now, if nobody gets hit because you're going 3 miles an hour on the interstate on the way home, you're going to slow others down. Everyone will hate you, and you'll never get home, all right? That's what's going to happen. Now, watch this. A simple change of metaphor shows that I should look back to help me look forward. Now, clearly, the Apostle Paul isn't wrong in Philippians 3, but when he says he forgets what is behind, he doesn't mean everything, especially because elsewhere he tells people, he encourages friends to remember, which institutes a looking back, a recalling the past. Also, if I'm counseling with someone and they're telling me that they're really struggling, like, to think well about faithfulness in their marriage, I want to ask them, what marriage was modeled in front of you? Like, how was your mom and dad's marriage? Or if somebody comes into my office and they say that they're really depressed or they're really anxious, I know that it's way more than them just hating work right now. They need to consider the entirety of their story to kind of help explain what they're going through and what they will go through. Or if somebody comes to my office and they're really angry and they have this anger problem, and I want to ask them, hey, what are the things in the past that have possibly nudged you to your present proclivities? The point is, you just can't lock the past in a vault and never think about it. But how? How do you do that? That's the question. How do you do Paul's forgetting what is behind? That's a Philippians question. But our question today is an Exodus question. And that is, how do you do the part where you look back as a way of looking forward? That's our primary concern this morning. It's like driving with no mirrors. It's like a wide receiver who turns to run with the ball before he's actually caught it. It's like investing in a company before you do your history, or marrying someone before you tell them about your past. Don't do it. Why? Because you have to look back to look forward. And in this Exodus narrative of set free, live free, do we just kind of basically get a set aside the set free part because that clearly ended with chapter 12? Of course not. Rather, we get to see how this set free piece and this live free piece are meant to be understood together. And as Israel steps into their freedom, they're called to remember the story of their bondage being broken. They're called to remember what God did. But it's not an arbitrary remembrance that they are called to. It's supposed to look like something very specific. So, yes, we're called to look back, to look forward. But how? How is the question? How did God want Israel to do that? And how should we do that in Christ as we seek to live in God's freedom today? And this morning, that's what we need to consider. And I believe Exodus 13 will help us think well about these things. Exodus 13, and we'll read all of it this morning. Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 through 22. How should we look back in order to look forward? Exodus 13, 1. Here we go. Yahweh, the Lord, special, intimate, covenant name of God. Yahweh said to Moses, consecrate to me all the firstborn. Whatever is the first to open the womb among the people of Israel, both man and beast, is mine. Then Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you came out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. For by a strong hand Yahweh brought you out from this place. And no leavened bread shall be eaten. Today in the month of Aviv you are going out. Verse 5. When Yahweh brings you into the land that the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites that he swore to your fathers to give to you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you should keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to Yahweh. Verse 7. Unleavened bread shall not be eaten for 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen with you, and no leavened bread shall be seen with you in all your territory. And you shall tell your son on that day, it is because of what Yahweh did for me when I came out of Egypt. Verse 9. And it shall be to you as a sign on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the law of Yahweh, the Torah Yahweh, may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand Yahweh has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this statute and its appointed time from year to year." So, stop for a second. As Israel leaves behind their days of toil and affliction, their eyes and their hearts are hopeful as they start to march in the direction of the promised land. This is one of the first things that God does tell them and does do for them. He goes, "All right, everybody, I need you to get out your cell phones. Could you get out your phones, please? Okay, thanks. Now open your calendar app. Now, okay, go ahead and scroll down to the month of Aviv. Go ahead and scroll down to the month of Aviv. Okay, now I need you to put this in for an entire week. So go ahead and put it in. And on the repeat section in the calendar app, put it in for every year. I want you guys to remember what just happened. Every subsequent generation, every Hebrew ever born has to know this story. And it's going to be a week-long kind of thing, and you're going to eat terrible bread, and so your kids are going to ask you questions about it. And Dad, why are we eating this gross bread for a week? And then you sit your kid up on your lap, and you tell them the story about how your grandparents were in horrible slavery. They were trapped, and they couldn't get out. They were totally and utterly desperate, and God came and God saved them, and He made a way out of slavery. He made an exodus, and that's why we have this special holiday. And what He did for your great grandpa is one of the many reasons why today we still want to love Him and trust Him and serve Him. Here's the deal, Christian parents, you get to do the exact same thing. All right, kids, look up here again. You have another special assignment aside from keeping mom and dad awake. You have a special assignment. This week, you need to ask mom and dad questions. Hey, mom and dad, why do we go to church? Why do we read and study the Bible? Ask mom and dad questions. Why do we try to love and trust and obey Jesus? Why do people get baptized? Kids, you need to be asking mom and dad questions. And mom and dad, you better answer well. Tell them a story of a God who came to save when we were trapped, when we didn't have a way out. Tell them again and again and again, never let it be far from your mouth. Tell them again and again about how God sent Jesus to make a way out, to make an exodus from our slavery to sin. And tell them that the best way for them to understand life as they move forward is to look back at what Jesus did for them. That's how the now liberated Israel was supposed to start thinking. They had just experienced the Old Testament gospel. And as they move forward, they're going to be wandering in the desert for 40 years. Then they're going to have 200 years of these judges back and forth and back and forth. And then Saul, David, and Solomon are each going to reign over all of Israel for 40 years each. And then the nation is going to divide, and they're going to go through dozens upon dozens of terrible leaders. And every year, God will give to them a gift in the form of this festival to remember their past as a means of moving forward. Part of Israel's continued future faithfulness to God was to look back, not at their faithfulness, but God's own faithfulness with this Feast of Unleavened Bread or Passover. But it gets a little bit more specific. Let's keep reading in verse 11. Verse 11. "When Yahweh brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as He swore to you and your fathers that He should give it to you, you shall set apart to Yahweh all that first opens the womb. All the firstborn of your animals that are males shall be Yahweh's. Every firstborn of a donkey you should redeem with a lamb, or if you will not redeem it, you can break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall also redeem." Now go ahead and just admit that sounds a little strange on the surface, so just let me explain. This is the Old Testament principle of the first fruits or the firstborn, and it was this reminder that everything belonged to God. So if you, on the first, give to God, what you're saying is this is an immediate and a really tangible reminder that everything that follows is a gift of His kindness. So as this, like, really holy and strange act of trust, Israel was called to sacrifice the firstborn of their flocks. But you're not supposed to do that with donkeys. You got to redeem donkeys, Shrek, because for Israel, donkeys were unclean, and you don't sacrifice that which is unclean to God. And they had just left Egypt, and they used donkeys in their working and their slavery. And so Egypt just said, "Take all those donkeys with you," but you weren't supposed to sacrifice a donkey because it was unclean. You're supposed to redeem it by sacrificing a lamb in its place. And to redeem something is to buy it back or to get it back with a cost. Also, speaking of donkeys, you should not sacrifice your firstborn son for a million reasons. One is it's a reminder of what God did in the last plague by providing a lamb in their place. Also because this was a practice in the ancient Near East and other religions of like pagan god worship. And we worship the one true creator and redeemer God, Yahweh, and not those other gods. And now, in my mind, it is kind of funny that he talks about donkeys and your own firstborn son in the same breath, but they're beside each other for a reason. And here's why. They're both unclean. And you know what that means? It means that Israel is sinful. We are sinful. We need a clean and spotless lamb to take our place. Israel needed that every year. So, verse 14, here we go. So, verse 14, when your son asks you, hey, Dad, what does this mean? You should say to him, son, by a strong hand, Yahweh brought us up out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And Pharaoh, he stubbornly refused to let us go. And Yahweh killed the firstborn in the land of Egypt, firstborn of man, firstborn among the animals. And therefore, I sacrificed to Yahweh all the males that first opened the womb, but of all the firstborn of my sons, I redeem. Verse 16, it shall be as a mark on your hand or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand, Yahweh brought us up out of Egypt. So when they are sitting on your lap and you're telling them a gospel story, don't just generally or broadly tell them that they were trapped and God made a way out. Tell them the very specifics of it, that God came to rescue them through the blood, by means of the blood of a clean Passover lamb. God came to redeem and he came to buy back. That's his strong and mighty hand that brings people up out of slavery. Also in verses 9 and 16, it says it shall be a sign between your eyes or your frontlets, which is such a fun word, or your frontlets and on your hand. And some of our Jewish friends and Jewish interpreters, they kind of over-literalize this, but basically it just means that this is for your head and for your hands, so that you can mentally recall and practically rehearse God's faithfulness and grace in the past. So know it with your head and act on it with your hands. And Christian mom and dad, you get better news to share with your kids than a yearly festival, which you eat terrible bread. Our gospel is way better than that. It's that Jesus is the true Passover lamb whose blood was shed once and for all, not repeated year after year. He's the spotless, blameless lamb that takes away our unclean, that takes away our sin. The way I teach James and Anna Jubilee, the way I teach them the gospel is that I say, hey, the gospel, James, is that Jesus came to take away our bad and give us his good. That's the gospel. That's what you're supposed to say to your kids when they're sitting in your lap. Believing in Jesus, that's how we know that we are free and that the promised land of the new creation is ahead of us. It's what awaits us. That's how Israel was thinking. How do I know that? Because verse 17 is them thinking about moving forward into the promised land. Look at verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt, equipped for battle. 19. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And they moved from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. 21, and Yahweh went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. Verse 22, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from the people. All right, I got a map for you. Check out this map right here. As they went to the promised land, they did not take the quickest way. They didn't. They took this way, hugging the coast. You see Tanis, T-A-N-I-S, there at the top middle. They took Tanis, or they didn't take Tanis all the way up to Gaza, hugging the coast. They didn't do that. Now, they didn't do that for several reasons. History tells us that the Egyptian pharaohs and stuff often kept battalions of troops on that like 30-mile-wide land bridge there to protect people from entering and exiting the country. And the Philistines actually did the same up closer to Gaza, because everything below that is just all desert. Rather than that, God led them southward, perhaps a little lower than the word Heliopolis right there. You see that? So if it's like the Red Sea is going, peace, man, like two fingers, right? The left finger, maybe near under Heliopolis, is where they cross the Red Sea in chapter 14 that we'll look at very soon. Now, as Moses went along this way, they didn't go the regular way God led them southward. As Moses went along this way, it says that he does something really strange. It's almost like an odd footnote in the story. It says he took Joseph's bones with him. And I think I counted it out. If this is not exact, then I think I'm pretty close. I think I counted out all the greats. Hey, Mo, what's in the box? Thanks for asking. It's just my great, 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 great Uncle Joe's bones. Which is funny, but it's also this very like subtle and quiet reminder that they're looking back as they look forward. They're looking back at this faithful God who was even faithful to Joseph as they move forward and press on into freedom. Now, the most important thing in these last few verses is how they conclude. God's presence is manifested in a very special way before them. It's this huge cloud tower during the day and a huge fire tower at night. And look how the chapter ends down in verse 22. Verse 22, the cloud by day and the fire by night did not depart from before the people. He never leaves us or forsakes us. When the writer of Hebrews quotes that in Hebrews 13, 5, it's a triple negative in Greek. It blows my mind. Sorry for being nerdy. It's like, he will not, no, ever not, never, ever leave us or forsake us. It's not just that we look back at Jesus as our Passover lamb who has taken our place and redeemed us and brought freedom and forgiveness. It's not just that we look forward to the promised land of new creation. It's that we can do those things humbly assured of God's presence with us. As Christians, God has fully given us his Spirit to guide us, to guard us, to equip us and protect us and enable us for what God has for us. And there's nothing that we can do or leave undone that will change that. He will not depart from his people. That's a promise. Now, I don't want to oversimplify Exodus 13, but I do have to point out some very simple language here. Just look and listen how many times it says Yahweh brought them out of Egypt or out of slavery. 3-3, 3-3 again, 3-3 a third time, 3-8, 3-9, 3-14, 3-16, 3-18. All of those say out of slavery or out of Egypt. But then the same verb bring is used with kind of a different prepositional idea, an into, bring into the promised land in 13:5 and 13:11 and with different language in verses 17 through 22. My point is very simple. The bring out of and the bring into, that's our big Exodus idea again. Set free, live free. And for our purposes this morning, looking back and looking forward. It's as if verses 1 through 16 are this way that they're supposed to look back. As they do, verses 17 through 22, look forward to the promised land. One of the most significant ways that Israel was to continue in their freedom was by intimately recalling the circumstances and means by which God originally brought them freedom. And as Christians today, we are called to do the exact same. If you are a Christian, if you're a follower of Jesus, the way that you look back at the gospel in order to move forward is not a quick fix. It's not God's MO. I'm so sorry if you want a quick fix or if our fast-paced world has lied to you. God's work on our hearts takes much more time. The looking back in order to look forward, it actually requires a little bit of effort. Applying the gospel to all of life is a little bit difficult. And God wants you to consider what he has done in Jesus and then press that into your current life situation. So if you do struggle with anger and you know that you don't have the self-control that you should, what you have to do, the way that you apply the gospel of Jesus, look back in order to move forward, the way you do that is you recall the patience of Jesus. He didn't deserve the cross, but he endured the cross. And you know what? You know what Isaiah says? It says he even did it without raising his voice. He was God's son, and he was treated like God's enemy so that you and I, who were God's enemies, could be brought into God's family. And so when you think, I have a justified reason for losing my mind and being angry right now. My boss is a liar. My kids just define disobedience. I have a right to be angry. When that happens, you need to take a deep breath and do verse 3 in Exodus 13. You need to remember, but you need to remember the New Testament gospel. Remember the divine patience that set you free. Look back and know for a fact that whatever you're angry about in the moment can't change how you stand before God. That's how you apply the gospel to your current situation. That's how you look back in order to look forward. And I'll take a deep breath and move on. If you're a Christian and you're depressed, you're anxious, you're really nervous about it, the gospel is that Jesus was abandoned so that you can be brought in. Jesus knows, he understands, there is no loneliness like that of the cross, ever. And no matter how anxious you are or isolated you feel, here's your comfort this morning. Jesus knows exactly how you feel, maybe even more so than you do. That's pretty isolated. My God, why have you forsaken me? And most importantly, he did that for you. He went to the cross for you, for your comfort, for your benefit. And now through his Spirit, he is with you by day and by night, and he's never going to depart from you. Jesus became lonely and gave himself up for you so that you would have a sense of belonging that nobody could take from you, even yourself. Yeah, you might need to chat with a counselor. You might need to take a little bit of medication, sure. But there is no level of depression or despair that can change how God views you in Jesus. Why? Because the good news about him is God's chosen medicine for our soul and our true health, both now and for all time. Here's what you have to see. This is what Exodus 13 is teaching, that we are supposed to look back at the gospel in order to look forward in freedom. For Israel and their Old Testament gospel, that was liberation from slavery in Egypt. For us and our New Testament gospel of our crucified and risen Jesus, that's that he frees us from slavery to sin and death. Now we're called to apply the gospel to all of life as we move forward into greater and greater freedom. Now, this is not easy. It can be difficult to think about appropriating the gospel in all of life. It's usually pretty difficult. In fact, this Passover seems like a pretty easy thing to do, right? But you know what? They often forgot the Passover. And when they did, you should read Israel's history and like the Kings and Chronicles. I know it's tough, but they just went astray. And one time a guy brought back the Passover, and guess what? Huge revival. Amazing things happened culturally, socially, and spiritually. This can be difficult to keep, to apply the gospel to all of life. Whether you're talking about dating or finances or parenting or sports or entertainment or politics, the gospel needs to be applied to all of that, and it's not easy. And because it's not easy, there are several things in Exodus 13 that I think will serve us as tracks to run on. So how do we look forward to look back? I think we should remember these things as we attempt to do that, as we attempt to press the gospel into all of life. I've got four brief suggestions. As we look back to look forward, we should remember these things. Number one, the power of ritual. Yahweh did not give Israel a suggestion, a proposal, or an option. He gave them a command and said, put it in your calendar on repeat every year. He knew that if they didn't think about it regularly, then their minds and their hearts would seek another source of identity. And like I just mentioned, that actually happened. Go read about Hezekiah in 2 Kings, and you'll see that that actually happened. But here's the idea. God has built both rhythm and ritual into the very fabric of creation, and he has also built rhythm and ritual into the very fabric of redemption, like Passover. Sabbath is like rhythm and ritual for creation. Passover is like rhythm and ritual for redemption. And in my mind, that means we need a sense of gospel ritual about our lives. I do think that includes things like corporate worship on Sunday morning, which I love. I think it includes things like community group. But I also think it can include more. Healthy ritual, healthy gospel ritual means we do it no matter what. And sometimes we just kind of show up only if we feel like it. Most every morning of my life, I try to get up and through just kind of bleary eyes, I make coffee. And then I sit at my little desk and I open my Bible and I try to have about 30 or 40 minutes with no human interaction. And if you know me, that's a big task, all right? And sometimes if my kids sleep late, I get an hour, all right? That's every morning of my life. But if I'm 100% honest with you, sometimes I'd rather just stay in bed or just sip coffee and look at that deer in my backyard. That's what I would rather do if I'm completely honest. But I know that there is something healthy and right about that kind of ritual in my life. Also think this is one of the reasons why God made smartphones. Do you know? This is the greatest thing ever. I have a thing set every Friday at 9 a.m. It tells me to pray for certain people. And every Friday at 9 a.m., not an alarm. It'll just come up on my screen. Bloop, pray for this person. Every Tuesday at lunch, I have it for somebody else. God made these things for a reason, okay? All right? Listen, you can create different gospel ritual in different ways and different kind of crevices and corners of your life. I don't know how you're going to do that. But I know that I have to have things like that that push me to stay rooted in the gospel and not seek some other source of identity on my own. So I think it's very healthy to find ways to do gospel ritual and gospel liturgy in your own lives. And so I think that will help us as we seek to move forward by looking back. So number one, the power of ritual. Number two, remember the principle of first fruits. These all start with P. You're very welcome. As we mentioned, the first fruits, or the firstborn in Exodus 13, represented the rest of the harvest, or the rest of the family. It was like a part stood for the whole. And so when you set apart that which is first, that's what verse 12 says to do, set apart that which is first. You're in essence saying, God, I know that it all belongs to you, and to remind myself that I know that's true, here's the first of the harvest, or the first of the flock. And as God guides you safely to the promised land, he also calls to give back to him freely and in remembrance of what he's done. So when we pass the offering plate, which I think is still kind of fun that we do here, when we pass the offering plate and we receive tithes and offerings here, that's not supposed to be if you have anything left over. The biblical idea is about first fruits. You give to God and his work first, acknowledging that it's all his to begin with. And here's the deal. God never asks you to do anything that he himself hasn't done. That's what he did for you. He gave you his firstborn son, Jesus. He gave you the very best of heaven. Why would we not do the same with the earthly gifts that he blesses us with? You are blessed to be a blessing, and we do that well when we look back at the gospel and think about this principle of the first fruits. So, power of ritual, principle of the first fruits. Number three, we remember the price of redemption. The price of redemption. Every year in this ritual, Passover, they were called to offer up their first fruits. Those are the first two things. But God didn't want them to offer their donkeys, but he also didn't want to offer them their firstborn sons. So he made redemption for Israel's firstborn. A lamb was offered in their place. And we also have John chapter 1. Behold, Jesus, the Lamb of God, the spotless Lamb of God, that takes away the sins of the world. And because he is the perfect spotless Lamb, he is the price of redemption. This is so powerful to me. Here's the thing. Now you're not just called to believe in him. You're called to actually follow his lead. The way that you move onward and experience freedom is to give your life away so that others can really live. And the way that you learn to give your life away is by looking at Jesus, because he did it perfectly. 1 Peter chapter 2 says, Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow so that you might walk in his steps. Romans 12 says, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. That's a joke. Sacrifices don't live. Offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is worship and pleasing to God. This is the idea of grace that we love so much here. There is a price of redemption for us, and you don't pay it. I don't pay it. Jesus paid it. He paid it all. And if that's true, get it. If redeeming grace is real, then wouldn't it perfectly show the glory and worth and value of that grace if we too gave our lives away? This is why we talk about serving and loving with no expectation of return. If we rightly understand the price of redemption that was paid for us, we'll start to act like Jesus and give our lives away. How do we look back to look forward? We should remember some things. Power of ritual, principle of the first fruits, price of redemption. And lastly, as we look back and look forward, we should remember the presence of God. The presence of God. I don't know what's in front of you right now in life. Like the stuff that when you go to bed at night and you put your head on your pillow, you're like, you're replaying those things or thinking about how you're gonna act in a certain situation. I don't know if it's an exam or a sports team that you play on. I don't know if it's college or if it's getting married or buying that house or selling that car, sharing the gospel with your coworker or your neighbor, or facing the scary diagnosis that the doctors have just given you. I don't know what it is. I do know that God absolutely wants you to view those things in proper relationship to the good news of Jesus, to rightly look back. But here's the thing you have to remember. The good news of God with us in Jesus creates the good news of God in us through the Spirit. And that means whatever is ahead of you, you will not face it alone. So the same God who stretched out the heavens and hung the stars, the same God who broke the power of slavery for his people in Egypt, the same God who has come to us in Jesus, and the same God that can't be held down by death and the resurrection, that same God is near you. He's closer than breath. He dwells within you if you are his child. Exodus 13, 22, by day and by night, he will not depart from you. He goes with you. He's good to us. He has called us out of darkness and into light, out of slavery and into a wide and spacious freedom. He has graciously delivered us. And as we consider our journey ahead, we will have greater confidence in the power of his nearness when we look back at his faithful love in the past. We must remember the presence of God in the past to see it and know it in the future and experience it in the future. I hope that the curiosity of the kids that are mentioned here in verse 13 or in chapter 13, I hope that curiosity becomes the curiosity of the world around us as Christians. So when people be like, man, why do you do what you do? Or why do you live like that? Or how do you have peace like you do? We can answer with great humility and great joy. It's because the Lord, with a strong and mighty hand, brought us out of slavery. And he gave us his firstborn son to die so that I might live. And that's how I have peace. That's how I have hope when I look at what's ahead. Fellowship Greenville, I pray that we can answer like that when the world around us asks. That Jesus is our reason. He's the way we make sense out of things. He gave up his life so that we can live. And that's our gospel. And we look back at that in order to look forward and move onward in freedom. And I hope you believe that good news this morning. Let's pray together. Jesus, we thank you so much that you came that we might have life. May we be so fixated and focused on that that we seek to give our lives away and enjoy the power and beauty of your presence. May we remember well, may we look back well so that we might look forward and move onward in great humility and great confidence and in great joy. Spirit, as we seek to apply the gospel of Jesus to all of life, help us to be faithful. Help us to see the worth and beauty of the gospel at every turn. Jesus, you're really good to us. We love you. Amen.